I'm going to talk today about some work that's been done over a number of years at Caltech and with a number of collaborators, including Jerry, Joel Burdick, John Hauser, a bunch of graduate students, both former and current. And so I'll try and sort of point out some of the things. And this is something that, for me, in some sense, started when I was a graduate student at Berkeley, and I took Jerry's course in geometric mechanics. And Jerry had a very interesting style, which was that every day in lecture, he would teach us about some abstract concept. And, you know, I was an electrical engineer, right? So I'm sitting there going, geez, do I really care about this stuff? But he would always say, you know, and this is going to be useful for understanding the satellite with rotors problem. Right? And I said, oh, well, that's something certainly useful, right? And at the end of every lecture, he'd say, now, this is, you know, you're going to see how this gets used, you know, in a little bit, right, on the satellite with rotors. We went through the entire term. I'm not sure we ever got to the satellite with rotors problem. But nonetheless, it forced me to be motivated and learn all of these things. And so you can tell Jerry that, that in fact, maybe I learned something about the satellite with the rotors problem. What I'd like to tell you about today is controllability of Lagrangian systems and a little bit of the work that was done at Caltech with Andrew Lewis and others. And then I want to talk about some of where that's led. Thank you, Roger. And in particular, I want to talk about differential flatness and real-time trajectory generation. And what happens when you try and do some of the control problems that come out of that. And then a little bit about what we're working on today in the lab and where things are headed. And really, this is a talk about the rigid body. So pretty much everything I'm going to say is really just about that rigid body in the plane with a couple of forces. So through all of this, it's all just about rigid bodies with forces. And that's really what I want to talk about today. And that's a problem that we did study in fact in Jerry's class. So when I talk about a Lagrangian control system, what do we mean? Well, we want to think about a mechanical system. So we've got a configuration space, and we've got a Lagrangian. But we also have external forces. And the external forces, of course, play a very important role. And so we'll write F for those external forces. And depending on the problem, we may also have a symmetry group and an action. We may have a constraint distribution if we're looking, for example, at some of the things that Krishna talked about, things rolling around. But for today, anyway, I won't use symmetries and constraint distributions so much. And there are lots of different ways that you can formulate this problem. You can write down the variational formulation of mechanics. And write that the variation of L not equal to zero here now, but equal to the force, the applied forces. Right? So that's where the forces enter into those equations. You can write it down in coordinates, and that's certainly the way that I was used to seeing it. So you've got some inertia matrix times accelerations, plus some Coriolis forces, maybe some nonlinear forces that might include gravity and friction, and then you've got this control force basis coming in, B of Q coming in. Or you can write a geometric formulation. So we can say that we've got an affine connection that we get from the kinetic energy metric, and we can write down the covariant derivative plus the gradient of the potential energy, and again, equals these forces that come up. And here I've written them as y instead of b because there's an m-inverse difference between those two things. And so I want to look at that class of systems that has this structure, and of course, in the usual way, we want to understand how do we exploit this structure for control problems. And so what are some of those control problems? So if I've got a mechanical system, I can talk about stability. And so we can look at, can we find a control law that's maybe a function of the configurations and a function of the velocities and possibly of time, such that we stabilize a given equilibrium point. We can stabilize more complicated things along the lines of what Roger talked about today. We can talk about a separate question, which is not stability, but controllability. Not can I stabilize a given equilibrium point, but can I move from one point to another point? Can I find an input, right, some set of prescribed forces so that I move from some initial position and velocity, configuration of velocity, to some final configuration of velocity. And then, as Roger nicely pointed out, we don't just want to think about, you know, can I get there, but can I actually do so stably? So can I do tracking? Can I follow a given trajectory robust to small perturbations and other things? And so this rigid body picture then simply becomes one where we'd actually like to move from some position and orientation to another position and orientation. We'd like to understand when can you do that? What are the techniques for actually generating the forces that give you a given trajectory? What do we know about that problem? And so that was a problem, in fact. It was interesting because I remember being in Waterloo at the Fields Institute. This was probably 8 years ago or something like that. Bill had invited me out and others, and Jerry was there. He was the director. And I remember walking around with Andrew Lewis, and we were walking around Waterloo and saying, geez, you know, we ought to be able to figure out the controllability of this thing in a nice, elegant way that uses all of this mechanics and other things. It took a little while, and Andrew's not in the room, so I can tell you it took quite a while to actually accomplish that. But we did, in fact, find a very nice way to exploit all of the structure of this, and so I'll tell you a little about that. So when you talk about controllability now, so I want to focus on that, when can we move from one point to another? You have to be careful about what it is you're actually asking, because there are several different notions of controllability that are slightly different. So you can talk about the notion of accessibility. That is, can I get from some initial equilibrium point, Q0, 0, through some application of U, so think about all of the possible U's that you can apply, and can I reach an open set of states, that is, an open set of both configurations and velocities, right? So we'll call that the accessibility problem, but that's not the only question that you can ask. I mean, after all, if you have, for example, a satellite with rotors, angular momentum is conserved, and so you certainly can't move to an open set of configurations of velocities, right? At a minimum, you have to have that the total energy is conserved, so you're constrained. So in fact, right, that problem would not be accessible, and maybe that's not the question you wanted to ask. So one of the things that it took to get this to work was to think about what are the right questions. So one of them was to think about configuration accessibility. That is, now the configuration part is important. Can I move from an initial equilibrium point to a final configuration where I get an open set of configurations, but I just get an arbitrary velocity? And that might be important if, for example, you want to move over some spot in the plane with your rigid body, but you don't really care about which direction you come across that spot. You just want to get to that spot. Or maybe even you want to hit a position and an orientation, but again, the exact velocity that you're going and whether you're spinning as you're doing it, you're not worrying about it. So we'll call that notion configuration accessibility. And then the strongest of these we'll call equilibrium controllability, and that is, when can I go from an initial configuration Q0 to an open neighborhood of equilibrium points around that? So now we're not just going to an open set, but also to an open neighborhood. However, we're requiring that they be equilibrium points. So for example, if I have the rigid body at rest, when can I move it to an arbitrary position and orientation around that rest configuration? So those are the three notions that we looked at and thought about and said, well, how do you characterize those? And it turns out there's a quite nice characterization in terms of some of the geometry that you get for mechanical systems. And so what are the operations that are going to come up? So if we write it in terms of covariant derivatives, so we've got nabla q dot equals the input forces, so I'm leaving off potential energy here just for simplicity, then these input forces are our control actions that we can apply. So I can take u1 and I can do something as a function of time, u2, u3, et cetera, up to um. And it turns out that we can express the controllability in the various forms that I gave you in terms of two basic operations. One's the usual Lie bracket that we see, and the other's something called the symmetric product. And so the symmetric product, the formula is given there, the covariant derivative of yj with respect to yi plus the swap of that, we write it in that way. And that term is something that actually came up, and that operator is something that came up in the work of Peter Crouch, who I think was working on gradient systems or something like that. And so, in fact, that dates back to Peter's work in the 80s. But it also came up in the context of these mechanical systems. And it's important to notice that even though this is a second-order system, that is, if I were to write it in coordinates, it would have been m of q, q double dot, right? The vector fields that I'm looking at, the y of q's, they're actually vector fields on the configuration manifold q. So they're sort of first-order vector fields, if you want. And now, if we have those two operations, we can define closure under those operations. So the involute closure is the usual closure under Lie bracketing, and then the symmetric closure will be the closure under the symmetric product. So we've got those operations that make sense for mechanical systems. So what can we say about controllability, then, for mechanical systems in terms of those operators? So turns out the configuration accessibility is very nicely formulated in the following way. Suppose that I have that same control system. I'd like to go, remember, configuration accessibility from some equilibrium point to an open set of configurations, but at arbitrary velocity. I'm not going to try and set the velocity. Then sufficient and essentially necessary, so necessary on sort of an open dense set condition, is that the Lie closure of the symmetric closure of the input vector fields span. Okay. So if this had been a normal control system, right, just first order vector fields, it would have been the Lie closure, right? That would have been the Frobenius theorem. You essentially don't want the Frobenius theorem to give you anything that's a submanifold. Right? But now, in fact, that we see for a mechanical system, still vector fields on Q, but we have to take the symmetric closure and then the Lie closure. Right? And so that's what you get. The proof of that is really pulling it up to the full state space, right? So the phase space, and then there keeping track of how the velocity enters, right? Because that's the part that you don't care about. And that was the work that Andrew Lewis did in this thesis, and showing that, in fact, when you extract out the various brackets and other things you need, you have to do a very careful calculation that you get this condition. But it's very nice, and Andrew has gone on and done some very nice work in terms of exploring the geometry of this. Again, just point out that all the computations are performed on Q, not on TQ. The symmetric closure is also something that you can think of as the geodesic closure. So you can say that a distribution is geodesically closed if whenever I take an initial position and velocity, so I take a position that's in that distribution and I flow along geodesics, that I stay in that distribution. Right? So very much like the Frobenius theorem, right, in the case of integrability. The Lie closure, of course, is just normal involute closure. And again, this test is necessary. So there's a condition that we can check. So I give you a mechanical system. with all of that structure, and I say, can I move to an open neighborhood of configurations at some velocity? Of course, that may not be the right question to ask, right? If I'm doing something like satellite pointing or I'm moving vehicles around, I don't necessarily just want to be, let's say I'm parking my car, not quite the framework here, but you can extend it to that. You know, it's not enough to get it in the parking space at some velocity, right? You actually want to get it there at zero velocity, usually, right? And so we'd like to ask really the equilibrium controllability question. So what does that look like? So the equilibrium controllability question, it turns out that what you need is you need to look at good and bad symmetric products. And if you know something about the work of Hector Sussman on the same question in the context of general control systems, then you get the same ideas. We'll define a particular bracket, symmetric product rather, to be bad if it contains an even number of copies of yi for each I, otherwise we'll say that it's good. And it turns out that if you have the same configuration accessibility condition plus all bad symmetric products or linear combinations of lower order good symmetric products, then you get equilibrium controllability. And the way to think about this is it has to do with reversal of time, right? So if we have even, if in the structure of the symmetric product, right, everything that occurs is something that has even numbers of yi's, right, then you can think about that's the direction I could move somehow by some complicated holonomy operation. How would I move backward in that direction, right? And if you've got even copies of everything, there's no easy way to do it by changing the signs of the u's, right? If you have an odd number someplace, right, then you're okay. You can change the sign of that u and somehow get it to go backwards. So that's sort of the intuition, and that's also the intuition of the theorem, of Sussman's theorem in terms of looking at those conditions. So again, all the computations are in Q, not PQ. We only have to really check the bad symmetric products, and we can extend this to allow the various other things that I've talked about that I'm not showing. So let's go back to this rigid body example that I said I wanted to use and look at that. So here's a planar rigid body with two independent forces. So we've got a rigid body with a center of mass. Offset from the center of mass, we have two forces that intersect at a point. Of course, they can really be arbitrary forces, right, pointing in any direction. And I can just pull them back to where they intersect at a point. And without loss of generality, I'll assume here that they're, in fact, orthogonal forces, right? Again, as long as I span, it doesn't really matter. And if you do that, then you can write down the vector fields on Q that define those forces, as you see there. And you can calculate out the Lie brackets, right? So there's the first Lie bracket, the symmetric products, right? There are all of the symmetric products. And we can go check to see whether or not these conditions are satisfied. So if we look at the symmetric closure and the Lie closure of the symmetric closure, then that, in fact, is true. It's configuration accessible. And you can see that because, in fact, Y1, Y2, and the bracket of Y1 and Y2, so I don't even need any of the symmetric products, span. And you see that just by looking at it. You've got essentially the d by d theta term is covered by your y1, and y2 and y1, y2 are essentially orthogonal to another, right? The sines and cosines are flipped around in the right way, right? And so that spans everything. So those three span everything. So it's configuration accessible. I can move the rigid body to any point at some velocity, right, an open neighborhood of points. But if I want to move it from here over to here, can I do that? And so then we have to check all of the brackets which have an even number of all of the yi's, right? And there's only one that happens that's non-zero, and that's the symmetric product of y1 with y1. So if you work all of that out, right, that symmetric product is twice that, right, because I had to add them. And in fact, that one is just a linear multiple of y2. Right? And so I can write it in terms of a lower order good bracket, right? The good brackets are the ones that don't have an even number of everything. Right? So this says that this is configuration accessible. I mean, configuration controllable. So that means that for a rigid body with two forces, really arbitrary forces, as long as they're not collinear, right, in which case I can't do anything, there's only one. And they don't both pass through the center of mass, because then my R term there would be zero, yes, right, so there's another one. Then, in fact, you can do that. And we've characterized all of the various things, you know, different types of forces and torques and other things, and you can go through and write all these things down. So that allows us to say whether or not something's controllable. Is it possible to hit an open neighborhood of sets? Really, though, the question is, okay, fine, it's possible, right? But I'd actually like to do it. I'd actually like to get from one configuration to another configuration. And so we'd like to really think about trajectory generation. That is, how do we compute the forces required to move from one point to another? And in fact, a lot of the work that we've done in my group over the last 5 years has been getting more and more sophisticated about this question. And there are two sort of general techniques that come up. One is holonomy, and you saw some examples of holonomy this morning in the talks that Roger gave and also some in Krishna's talk, where you do somehow cycles in the shape space, right, and you get a geometric phase out of this and you get motion. And so that's certainly one way to do it, and you can exploit a lot of that structure, and there's some really rich and interesting problems there. What I want to talk about today is a slightly different way of doing it, which is using a property called differential flatness. And differential flatness also exploits that structure, but in a slightly different way in terms of thinking about how to generate trajectories. So what is differential flatness? Let me show it to you in the context of an example. So here is a flight control system. All right, it is a ducted fan, so there's a little fan, and the top part there has a fan spinning in it that blows air down. And at the bottom, I have some flaps that I can move around. Okay, and I'll show you this flying around in a second, and you'll get a little bit better visual picture of it. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to move that, let's say, from just sitting at hover, so it's blowing air down, so it's holding itself up against gravity, right? And I'd like to move it over maybe to a different spot, right? Some other position. In this case, because of gravity, there's no equilibrium point at a different orientation, right? Because I can't blow down and hold myself up without giving myself a torque unless I'm pointed exactly straight. And so if you write down the equations for that, they're given there. And of course, if you look at this, right, it's just the rigid body with two forces, right? I mean, there's nothing different about it at all, and F1 and F2 are those two forces. And so we can check all of the conditions. We already know that it's equilibrium controllable. But if you want to think about moving on trajectories, there's a trick you can play here, which is to use something called differential flatness. And it turns out that if you look at the center of oscillation of this, so Huygens defined this thing called the center of oscillation for a rigid body, then that center of oscillation has coordinates z1 and z2 that I've written down there. So it's x minus j over mr sine theta and y plus j over mr cosine theta. That's essentially, do you have your laser pointer, Jerry? No. Does someone have Jerry's laser pointer? Just so I can show you. So the dot that's sitting up above the center of mass, excellent, thank you. So if you take this rigid body and you move to a point that is a distance J over MR above the center of mass, that's the center of oscillation for a rigid body. Right? J is the moment of inertia, M is the mass, R is the distance between where the forces act and the center of mass. And so the that point, if you now look at that point, and you notice that if I take the acceleration of z1, the acceleration of this point, and I divide it by the acceleration of this point minus gravity, right, then you just do a little bit of algebra with these equations, and you get this equation right here. Now, why is that interesting? Well, because it means that if I know what z1 is as a function of time and z2 is a function of time, I can certainly calculate out what these accelerations and ratios are as a function of time. And that means I know the left side of this. And that means I now have three equations, z1, z2, and this thing, and three variables, x, y, and theta. And so it means that I can characterize every trajectory of this system, right, in terms of just z1 and z2. That is, every path for z1 and z2 corresponds to an x, y, theta, x dot, y dot, theta dot, f1, f2, because I use these equations to get it, that satisfies those equations of motion. And furthermore, any trajectory of this, of course, I can just write down what z1 and z2 are. So there's a one-to-one equivalence between the motion of this rigid body with control forces and curves of this point in the plane. And that makes a huge difference in terms of thinking about generating trajectories. So now we can basically look for feasible trajectories of this set of dynamical equations by searching over all of the curves in the plane. Right? So we're just looking for curves as a function of time that map us into z1, z2, and there's a lot of other things that you can do with it. And just to sort of show you how that trajectory generation problem goes, I'm going to write it as first-order vector fields just to make it easy, but really x here is just q and q dot. Which is in some manifold, which is my phase space. And I'd like to go from x0, some initial position and velocity, to some final position and velocity by choosing u. And I'm going to assume here that I can write x and u that satisfy these equations as some function of some variable z and some finite number of derivatives. Right? If you think about how to get x, y, theta, I need two derivatives, right? I need another set of derivatives to get x dot, y dot, theta dot, and one more to get f1 and f2, right? So I need four derivatives in this case in order to get everything, so q would be four here. And if you think about this problem for a while, the problem of moving from some initial x and from some initial state, right, there's a one-to-one equivalence between those initial states and z, z dot up to zq, right? If I give you those initial positions and tangents and everything else of z, I can figure out what the initial condition is. And so, in fact, the problem of moving from x0 to xf is equivalent to the problem of going from z0 and up to q derivatives to z at time t and up to q derivatives of z. Right? But there are no constraints on z anymore. So this is a trivial problem, right? This is just moved from some initial point, tangent, curvature to some final point, tangent, curvature, find the curve. Trivial to solve, right? One of the things you can do is you can just take a set of basis functions, right, for z, write it in terms of some set of complete basis functions, and then when you plug all of these things in over here and plug all of these things in over here, right, you can actually get and solve for the alphas, and it's just a linear equation. This m depends on time 0 and time t derivatives of my basis functions, right? I get m times alpha equals this, invert m, I'm done. Right? So it is now, for differentially flat systems, trivial to generate a trajectory from one point to another. Right? And that rigid body, right, that planar rigid body, is in fact differentially flat. So we want to use this structure of differential flatness to generate trajectories and to do interesting things. It came from people thinking about algebraic geometry and flatness in that context, and this concept, and I think I've got it back on one of these charts, is in fact, it's not on one of these charts. So it's in fact due to Michel Fleiss, Ruchon, and Martin, thank you. And so they were the ones who defined it in a different context, right, as flat in that way. Okay, so we want to now use this property of differential flatness to generate motion for real systems. And so one of the things we want to do is characterize flatness. And so, in fact, for mechanical systems, you can characterize flatness. And you can talk about, in the same way that we talked about configuration controllability and equilibrium controllability, we can talk about configuration flatness. That is, if I'm given a mechanical system, then when can I find a flat output that depends only on the configuration variables? Right? That's the configuration flatness part. And in this particular case, there's a condition due to Murahan-Rathenam for the case where you have n minus 1 controls. So, for example, for the rigid body, we have 3 configuration variables, that's n, right, and 2 controls, so it applies to this case. And the theorem is, in fact, one that can be written in terms of all of these covariant derivatives, right? So there's a little bit of a calculation you have to go through here. You have to look at the vector fields that are perpendicular relative to the kinetic energy metric to your input forces. Right? And then you have to go through and check this theorem to find a vector field that's perpendicular to that, but also one that's perpendicular to all of the covariant derivatives of C with respect to these Zs, right, where Zs are all vector fields on Q. So there's some regularity conditions and other things, but it turns out that the ducted fan, right, so with the gradient terms in there, and also the planar rigid body with forces are differentially flat. And we have a test for those things. And so we know they're differentially flat. Finding the flat output from this condition, you can go through the proof. It's a mess. You've got to solve a PDE someplace, right? And in fact, the tried and true way to find flat outputs is to essentially pick a system that you don't know whether or not it's flat. And then you go talk to Pierre Ruchon, and you say, Pierre, this system is not flat, right? And then 6 months later, he comes back and tells you what the flat outputs are. So that's the actual technique for figuring out flat systems if you need it. And I'll give you Pierre's email address. It has worked wonderfully for me. He has proved many, many things are flat. And I have no idea how he does it. It's some magic in his head. He can't write it down as a paper either. So that's the technique. So you do. There's a little bit of guessing, but you can check to see whether it's flat. That's easy enough. It's just figuring out what the flat outputs are. So we know when systems are differentially flat, mechanical systems are differentially flat. We went out and see, suppose we look at that class of flat systems. What can we do with it, right? What interesting things can we do with this fact about these systems? And so one of the things that we've spent some time looking at is real-time trajectory generation. And so the trajectory generation problem is essentially how do you move from one point to another, but there are times when you'd like to do this fast, right? And so you'd like to do it in real time. And so you can imagine a situation, for example, where you've got some airplane and you've got a pilot back here, and the pilot's going to say, I want the airplane to go fly along this path. The problem is that if the pilot's not in the airplane, like you're talking about an uninhabited aerial vehicle or something, and the pilot's on the ground, the pilot gives it a path in three space that may or may not be a solution to the dynamics. Right? What you'd like to do is you'd like to take that and take a trajectory generation module that follows that path as closely as possible, but that gives you a system that actually satisfies the dynamics of the system. So we'd like to find feasible trajectories given some specification of what we'd like the trajectory to do. And if the system's differentially flat, right, I can choose a set of basis functions here and solve out that linear equation, and just, boom, I can do it that fast. And that means that the pilot can be giving this information to me real time, right, and I can just be generating those trajectories in real time. And that turns out to be an incredibly powerful idea, and we've taken this and done a lot of work on it in the context of flight control systems. So here's a slightly nicer picture of a rigid body with two forces on it, right? This is supposed to be the ducted fan, that kind of green thing's where the fan is. Here's a wing, and then here are the flaps at the bottom. This is the actual experiment that we've built. So the fan unit is inside there. There's a little fan that spins around. You'll hear it in a minute. And then here are the flaps at the back. And there's a wing on this thing, so you have aerodynamic forces. And so you have to worry about, with aerodynamic forces, is this thing differentially flat, right? It's not going to fit into mechanics anymore, but it might fit into flatness. So you call up Pierre, you say it's not differentially flat. 6 months later, he writes a paper and shows that it's differentially flat, right, by finding the outputs. So in fact, this is differentially flat too, subject to some assumptions and other things. And what that allows you to do, for example, is do trajectory generation like this. So here is a reference trajectory that was given by Michiel van Nieuwstad sitting at a joystick and saying, this is what I want the ducted fan to do in terms of its x position, that's the position around this circle that it flies in, and time. Now, that trajectory is not actually feasible. It does not satisfy the dynamics. I can't follow that trajectory in x directly. But what we can do is we can calculate out a feasible trajectory using differential flatness, and then we can follow that feasible trajectory. We can give that as an input to our control system, and we essentially, if there's no uncertainty, we would just give it that input and it would fly it. But of course, we've got model uncertainty and initial state uncertainty, and so we wrap a control law around that and stabilize it. In fact, we get something that's very close to that trajectory. And you see that there's a little bit of a delay here, right? That's because we have to go calculate, right? And so, you know, there's a question about how long do you have to, how much trajectory do you need before you can start calculating the trajectory? And these are a bunch of engineering issues that are all very interesting. And so we work on that. The other thing that has to happen is you do have to be able to solve these trajectories quickly. And while it's relatively simple to solve it for the case where it's differentially flat and there are no constraints on the inputs or states, it gets a little bit trickier if your inputs or states are constrained. So, for example, in this particular system, there's a ceiling up here, so you better not get a trajectory that goes up too high, and there's a floor down here, and so it better not go down too low either. So how do we fit that into the framework? In addition, there are input constraints. We can only bend the flaps so fast. They can only bend so far. All of those things have to be put in, too, if we want to get this to work. So we think a lot about how to do that. And in fact, you can use this idea of flatness to do real-time trajectory generation with all of those constraints. And we use a collocation technique. So essentially what we do is we say, let's suppose that we have a differentially flat system. We can write the states and inputs. And if it's flat, we would do this in terms of Z. But in fact, the technique works even if it's not. But we can write the states and inputs as combinations of basis functions. And then the collocation technique would just say, check to make sure that these differential equations are satisfied at instantaneous times Ti. Right? And so when I do that, I get a whole bunch of algebraic constraints on what the alphas are. They're now nonlinear if I have constraints and other things. If it's flat, I can do something a little bit simpler. I know automatically that it satisfies the differential equations, but if I have additional constraints on the states, they will turn out to be constraints on these coefficients alpha. And you can do something in the middle. If it's partially flat but not all the way flat, you can get some differential constraints left instead of none, and so there are a lot of ideas. But one of the things you can do is you can now generate trajectories. And so, for example, if I tell the ducted fan that I'd like to go from here at hover over to here at hover, but I'd like to miss the ceiling, and there are two people standing out in the workspace, and I'd like to miss them too, right? So we'll cover them with these little hump-shaped envelopes. Then we can give that problem, and we can also say that the input forces need to live in this triangle, right? Where's that triangle coming from? Well, you're vectoring the thrust, so you can only generate as much side force as you're thrusting, right? So if you're thrusting at zero force, right, then, of course, you get no side force. That's this point down here. But if you're thrusting with quite a lot of force in the Z direction, that's vertical, then you can get some amount of force from vectoring it around. And this is the solution that NTG, a software package that we wrote, came up with. Right? So it touches the constraint up there, just touches it. And look at the inputs. Right? They're all staying inside this triangle, except, of course, here. Right? It's a collocation technique, so the constraints are only satisfied at your knot points where you choose the collocation. And so this is between knot points. So you've got to back off a little bit on your constraints and do all of the usual things. But we can solve this particular problem very fast, and I'll show you how fast. And so we've taken that idea and gone and used it for sort of the next step of things, which is now if I can generate trajectories really quickly, then I can think about doing something called optimization-based control. So normally we think about control, right? I give you a system, and I go off, and I think for a long time, and I design a feedback law that stabilizes that system. Right? Well, a different way that you can do that is you can say, well, suppose I have a system, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to choose a U that minimizes some cost function. So that cost function is an integrated cost over a time horizon capital T plus some terminal cost that defines what I want it to hit at the end of that time. And if I have this real-time trajectory generation working, I can essentially search over all of the feasible trajectories and minimize this, right? In differential flat space, that's just a search for a set of solutions for the alphas that satisfy all of my constraints and everything else, and then with whatever freedom is left, optimize some function of the alphas that's given by this thing. Okay? So I can do all of that. It's an algebra problem. There's no dynamic programming or other things going on. We can do it from an initial condition to a final condition that moves forward in time with an arbitrary nonlinear dynamical system and arbitrary constraints on the state's input smoothness and all the other niceness properties. It's important in doing this, there are a couple of properties. One is it matters if you're looking at stability. If you're constantly optimizing over a fixed horizon, you can show that there are systems for which, in fact, you go unstable. You do the optimum thing over the fixed horizon, but in the long term, you actually drive the system unstable. And having this terminal cost have certain properties, and in fact, the property we want here is that it's a control-Lyapunov function, then you can guarantee stability for these systems. And furthermore, you can think of this control-Lyapunov function kind of as a cost to go. So the idea is that you minimize in detail what happens over this period, and then you try and minimize this cost to go, right? And if you knew exactly what this cost to go was for the optimal problem, right, then you wouldn't even need this front-end piece. But in fact, you use an approximation of the cost to go, and so this front-end piece gives you the optimality that you want. So in the absence of constraints, you can prove stability. If you take the terminal cost piece here, plus the fact that it's differentially flat, That allows you to shorten up the horizon because of the terminal cost and solve things very fast, and that lets you get fast enough to implement these in real time. And so you can actually implement this on a system that has relatively fast dynamics. So in process control, this idea has been used for a long time, sometimes called generalized matrix control and other things, but the time scales there are hours, right? So you got, you know, a half hour to solve the optimization problem, okay? The time scales that we run our system at is about 50 hertz, so you got 20 milliseconds to solve the optimization problem. That's a lot different. All right? And so what can you do in 20 milliseconds? You can do a lot if you exploit all of this structure. So in fact, we've done that on the ducted fan, and I want to just I won't go through all of the details. If you're interested, there's an ACC paper that just appeared that has all of this. But we essentially took this ducted fan and implemented this. And so what we did was, there's a person sitting back here out of view who is commanding where the fan should go dynamically, and you'll see it sort of move, and then the system is automatically computing out over a 2-second horizon with a terminal cost how to get there. It implements that for about 20 milliseconds, right? It then recalculates it, implements that input for the next 20 milliseconds, recalculates, 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 and of course you get feedback in there, because when you recalculate from the state you're actually at, right? Not from necessarily the state you thought you'd be at, and so that gives you your feedback loop that gives you your stability. All of this is running on what, at the time that we started it, was a lot of computation. It had two TI C30 DSPs and two 500 megahertz, used to be DEC, then it became Compaq, now HP, I guess, alpha processors. Nowadays, that's about, you know, sort of a Pentium 4 at 2 gigahertz, right? So, I mean, this is laptop-level stuff almost nowadays, a couple of years later. So we can do this, and we're getting effective servo rates of about 20 hertz. So, in fact, it's a little bit more like 50 milliseconds to do this, but that's fast enough. So let me show you what this looks like. I'll let you listen to it too. So this is really flying. The aerodynamics matter, the constraints matter. He's now going to tell it to go back, I think, a whole time around. So he's just going to say, be on the other side of the room. The system says, okay, I will optimize. I will move around to the other side of the room. Oh, I better stop. I'll pull back, right? And then it stops right where he told it to stop. Okay. Very large maneuvers. Right, very fast, very aggressive, pushing up against the constraints, pushing up against the aerodynamics. Right, all of those things matter in this, and yet we can get this to run. And again, the properties we're exploiting are differential flatness, right, which comes from essentially, it's not quite differentially flat, but close enough. Right, so the basic mechanics of the rigid body really are the starting point for understanding how this thing is differentially flat, and then we can get those things to run. So. I often tell the controls class, you know, this is sort of the end of control, because now all you need to do control is specify a model for the system and a cost function for the system and the constraints, right? Kick it into this software package and you're done, right? Don't have to design control laws anymore, right? And of course, the reality of that is that's true. You can do that if you can figure out what the cost function is, right? And that's where now the art moves to, is figuring out how to get the cost function that does what you want. It does take a while to get cost functions, because minimizing energy when you've got all these constraints and other things may not be the right answer. So all of these ideas have led to really thinking about how to implement these real-time trajectory generation procedures and what to do with it. What do we do next, right? I mean, so we've got this stuff running on a single vehicle. Well, the next thing you start thinking about is multiple vehicles. So Krishna talked about having lots of vehicles. Here we're only looking at three. But now you can say, let's suppose that I can just solve these real-time trajectory optimization problems in real time. Let's take that as a primitive. What might I do with it? Well, for example, I might think about the following problem. Can I move three vehicles equally spaced on a circle such that the center of that circle follows this trajectory, right? Three rigid bodies in the plane with two forces, right? So just doing that system. And how might we do that? Well, one way we could do it, of course, is we could take the full dynamics of the system, each of the rigid bodies, right? So the three configuration variables, six states for each one times 18 states. Every vehicle, each vehicle on its own, they all have local computation, could solve this 18-state optimal control problem, right, and then implement their piece, right? As long as they all stayed synchronized, right, so you'd have to communicate information back and forth, you could do it. And that would actually work for three vehicles, but if I took Krishna's case, and he had, I don't know, what, 10, 12, right, that's pushing it, right? If I do 100, I'm screwed, right? I'm never going to get there, right? So we want to do something better than that. So what do we do? Well, one of the things that we've thought about is, well, maybe I can use some sort of a reduced order model for the rest of the world. That is, maybe this blue vehicle here doesn't need to know everything about the position and dynamics and details of what's going on here and here. Maybe I can just make some assumptions this thing's going to move in a simple way. And in fact, we tried it out, and so I'll show you a simulation of this, where all we did was we said each vehicle will model its neighbors as moving in a straight line at the velocity it's currently going. Okay? And then it will try to optimize its position to satisfy the desired objective. So I'm going to assume that those two vehicles are going to do what they're going to do, and then I'm going to try and get the spacing to be equal, right, around the circle as best as I can, and I'm going to try and get it so that the center of the circle tracks that velocity. And then the yellow vehicle is going to do the same thing relative to the blue and the green vehicle is going to do the same thing. And we see whether or not that works. So I'm going to show you a simulation of that. It's got two pieces to it running at the same time. The first thing you'll see is these black triangles with the colored square in the middle. That's the global MPC problem, right? You're solving the whole problem. You know everything about everybody, and you solve it. And then I'm going to show you just the colored triangles are the ones that show you with the local information. So you'll see what the difference is between these. And in fact, with a little bit of work, you can get this to work quite well. So this shows what happens there. And you see these things do a good job, and basically they're great except at the corners, right? And why aren't they good at the corners? Because that's where my assumptions about the rest of the world break down, right? Because you don't move in a straight line at the velocity you're going, right? Your neighbors, they turn, right? And so you get a little bit of transient there because as they turn, right, you miscomputed where they were going to go, and so you have to correct that, but it's all in a feedback loop and it works fine, right? And so now we are able to sort of use this as a primitive and do more complicated things with multiple vehicles and think about what happens. And again, the details of this are in a recent paper that we've written. We've also thought a little bit about, okay, well, this is neat, but, you know, I told you all that for the rigid body, right? And then everybody kind of perks up when I show the video of it on the experiment because you know it's really working on a real experiment. So we want to try this in experiments too, and Krishna mentioned this. This is a new testbed that we're building. We call it MVWT, the Multi-Vehicle Wireless Testbed at Caltech. It consists of a bunch of vehicles, the red and the blue vehicles here, that have these little fan units on them running around. This is the lab that we have. That's the ducted fan sitting back there in the lab. You see the ducted fan there, so this is the post in the center of the room. That's an obstacle. You're not allowed to run into that. It has cameras up above it that look down that can give us the position of all of the vehicles in the workspace. And the vehicles can communicate with each other across 802.11, Bluetooth, or infrared if we wanted to use that, which we don't. But nonetheless, we can communicate in different ways. And the vehicle looks like this. All right, so rigid body with forces. All right, so it's a body. It's got ball casters on the bottom, so this lets it roll around in any direction, relatively low friction. And then it's got two fans on it that we can control individually. So we can differentially put the fans on. If we put them both on at the same time, we get a force at the line. Right, if we put one a little bit more than the other, we get a torque. Right, so that's exactly right the rigid body with two forces. So in 12 years, I still haven't gotten off of this one problem. But nonetheless, it gets a little bit more complicated when you start doing multiple vehicles. And these are very interesting systems. And so just to kind of give you a sense of this, this is some early work. This is actually from about, I guess, probably May when we were first getting the vehicles up and running, maybe earlier than that. And I just want to show you what the dynamics of this looks like. So this is a human flying this around, just controlling with a little RC controller directly the forces on the two motors. And you get a little bit of a sense of the dynamics. And what this is Lars Kramin, I think, flying this around. And what he's going to try and do, he's going to get it from here, he's going to try and take it to the other side of the lab, turn around, and come back. All right? In fact, he's going to try and get here at an equilibrium point and then bring it back to here at an equilibrium point. That's a little bit tricky, right, because this thing, once you give it a push, it keeps going, right? So you actually have to turn around and slow down, right, in order to solve the equilibrium controllability problem. Okay, so this is what that looks like. So remember, he's trying to go over here. I mean, it's not so easy, right? Because this thing spins around, you know, oh, nope, too far, wait, no, right? And then it's like, oh, no, right? I got to stop, right? Because this thing's going to run off the edge. That's about a 6-inch drop off that back edge, right? Now he comes back, right? And on this end, he manages to get it going, and he's sort of okay. He spins it around, you know, applies the force, right? And he sort of stops, okay? So that's what the dynamics of that look like. So this trajectory generation problem is not quite so trivial, right? It's just sort of saying, oh, yeah, go from here to there, right? It's a little bit trickier than that. And it's pretty hard for humans to do, even for a simple planar rigid body. We've also thought some about, you know, putting the control on this, of course, and we want to do that to make it a lot simpler. Here is now the same system. What's happening here is there's a hat on top of this that has a pattern. It's picked up by the vision system that looks down, so we get the position and orientation. And we can just wrap a feedback controller around it. And this is just an early test where we're flying it around in a circle just to sort of show that we've got all the components of it working. I'm going to get my mouse up here. And this is what it flies around. So it's flying a circle of 1 meter, 2 meter radius, and then it comes into 1 meter. Right? And you see the theta dynamics that were so hard to control, they're controlled, right? I mean, this thing isn't vibrating around a lot. It's just going around the circle like it's supposed to. You'll see it here, unfortunately, right when it goes behind the post. All right? It now comes in to a narrower circle, right? So it does a smooth trajectory in. And then you'll see it turn around so that you can get a sense of the transient response. And this one doesn't happen behind the post, so you'll see it. And then they turn it around and tell it to go in the other direction. and then it turns around and comes back in that other direction. Right? So once you put control on this, now you can start to get some of these things to go. Of course, 8 of these vehicles all in the lab at once, right? It's going to be loud, it's going to be interesting, it's going to be a lot of fun, and so we'd like to see how all of that works. So what do we want to? So there's our test bed that we want to try some of these ideas, these distributed optimization problems, multiple vehicles following one another. What do we really want to do with this? Well, the thing that we'd like to try and do is play RoboFlag. So let me just say a little bit about RoboFlag, because you're going to be hearing this in the next 10 years probably out of my group. So what's RoboFlag? RoboFlag is Robot Capture the Flag. So here's the game. You've got 10 robots, in fact, we use on the blue team and on the yellow team. The 10 robots on each team, if you're on the yellow team, what you want to do is you want to go inside this circle. At that point, there's a flag. You capture the flag. You move over the flag. And then you come back into your little home zone here. When you capture the flag, you get 5 points. When you move back into your home zone, you get 25 points. Right? Of course, the other team's doing the same thing. As a defender, you're allowed to stay out. You're not allowed to go inside the circle. You have to stay outside the circle. But if you tag one of the opposing team as they come across on your side, then they're disabled, and they get towed back into their home region, and they lose a point. Right? So the idea is the blue team wants to come and defend this thing. The yellow team wants to come and come in here and get it. Of course, the blue team wants to also come in and capture the flag. You've got 10 robots, right? What do you tell them all to do? Bunch of planar rigid bodies with forces. Okay, nothing more than that. So a couple of other things just to make the game interesting. If that's not enough, there are these little obstacles that are floating around. If you hit an obstacle, you are red carded. Right? You're thrown out of the game for the whole game. Right? So all of a sudden, you don't get to play anymore in that game. So you got to think about not hitting these obstacles. Serious constraint. Okay to hit another team member, you just get tagged and pulled back and disabled. Or not a team member, but the other team, you just get tagged and pulled back. The other thing that we put in are little scoring balls. So these scoring balls, the yellow team can pick up their scoring balls and shoot them at the blue team. And if they hit them with a scoring ball, then the blue team member loses a point and gets disabled and towed back into their home region. Right? So you can actually just pick these guys off from across the field if you want. Right? Of course, they're doing the same thing. So if you're just standing there, you know, sort of shooting scoring balls, they're probably doing the same thing. Right? The scoring balls move fast. You don't move that fast. Right? So it's like a paint gun game or something, right? Except with robots. So the other thing that we're putting into this is that we'd really like to think about how do we integrate humans into this. Okay? So to make it yet more interesting, there are 2 humans on each team. 10 robots, 2 humans. Question, what do the humans do? Right? You can't have them control the individual robots drive along. There's 10 of them, right? You can't do that. Right? Maybe the computer ought to tell the humans what to do, right? You know, sort of, here's what I want to do, but this one's tricky. Why don't you plan out a path for that, right? Or maybe the humans ought to sit up on top and call plays, right? Like a coach on the sidelines, right? You get 2 of them, so you get to decide what to do. So this is the game that we're doing, and we're doing a lot of sub-pieces of this, right? The formation one might be a bunch of people circling around this thing trying to keep equal distance, right? There's limited sensing, by the way. These things can only see in a radius that's about a little bit bigger than the size of that ball. Right? So they can't see everything. Right? They can communicate to each other, right? But they have to communicate, okay, I saw a robot over here, and I now see it doing this. Right? You don't get global vision like you see here. Right? You get what you see if you're on a soccer field. You can't see people behind you. Right? So same thing. Now, we actually have a project going on. There are 3 Cornell students sitting at Caltech right now that are designing a system to play this game, and 3 Caltech students that are sitting out at Cornell right now on the 23rd of August at 3 p.m. in Ithaca, New York. If you're around, they're going to compete. All right. So there and whatever they started on the 19th of June. Okay, and they were given a simulator for this thing. There's a real physical test bed at Cornell. This is all joint work with Raf D'Andrea, and that physical test bed is where they'll compete. Right, and the team that wins, and it'll either be Caltech or Cornell, and we'll see how it goes. So stay posted. Good. So we've been using that system to think a lot about what types of problems are going to be important if you want to do that sort of a game, right? And this isn't all that different from things like the air traffic control game, right, where you want to keep a bunch of airplanes and you got weather all of a sudden, you need to avoid that weather but not reroute everybody's flight, right? How do you do that? It's not all that different from that. So there are a lot of interesting control challenges. One of the ones that we've been looking at is how do you specify trajectories? So we've been using some ideas in stream functions, sort of like potential flow, but really using stream functions like you have in fluid mechanics, right? So we come back to mechanics as a way of thinking about how to plan these things. And let me not go through the details of this in the interest of time, but let me just show you some work that Steve Wado, a grad student just starting at Caltech, has done. And what this is a drill where that robot is supposed to come in, capture the flag, and then go back up to that point. Of course, these things are defending the goal, and what's going to happen is here the defenders are doing something pretty stupid. They're just going around in a circle in one direction, and then the outer ones are going around in a circle in the other direction, and this thing just has to come in and go out. It'd be a trivial problem for something where we wanted to sort of solve that, just that one problem with something like NTG, but we wanted to do it with these stream functions. So each of these, you can think of this as you got a rubber sheet, and you really just pull down on that rubber sheet right where that X is, and then you push up on the rubber sheet wherever these obstacles happen to be, and then you pour water on the rubber sheet and see how the water flows down into the drain. Okay, that's the solution that's going to follow. And you get pretty interesting looking trajectories. The potential changes because these things change. And we do stream functions rather than potential flow, which you could do potential functions, and there's a lot of navigation with potential functions, but the trajectories don't look so nice for mechanical systems. Right? So the stream functions, right, because you sort of think of fluid mechanics flowing the particles, they look a lot nicer. So, interestingly. It's not a gradient flow, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, here's what that looks like. So the vehicle comes in, it avoids that guy, and says, okay, good, now I'm going to come in here, right? Oh, these two are going to pinch me off. I'll duck out of there, right? Actually doesn't touch, right? Gets close, right? Comes in, catches the flag, we then switch it, right? We put the sink on the other end, right? And make it go back the other way. Right? So that's what stream functions look like applied to a rigid body with two forces in the plane. So, good. So, there's lots of really interesting problems, I think, sitting in this, and we've had a lot of fun thinking about it. So just to sort of summarize, really this whole talk has been about thinking about, right, rigid body with two forces. Nothing that I've said doesn't essentially come back to a rigid body with two forces. Of course, the important part is we want to think about moving rigid bodies with two forces, right? And how do you get from one point to another? And of course, it gets a lot more complicated as you start to get multiple ones, and some of them are controlled by humans and lots of other things. But looking at some of the controllability of Lagrangian systems and how the structure of those goes through, where might we put the forces? When we design our vehicles, by the way, we've got to decide where do we put the fans, how far out, do we cant the fans or not, and these types of problems. And understanding the mechanics of it's important. Differential flatness and real-time trajectory generation, where we exploit the mechanical structure to parameterize the trajectories and then do things very fast in terms of the real-time trajectory generations. I think that has very important implications for control and for vehicle control and motion control. And then lastly, a little bit about where we're headed, the multi-vehicle testbed, which is a new testbed that we've put together for thinking about control, computing, and communications, and RoboFlag, which is a new testbed for really thinking about control at higher levels of decision. So, thank you very much.